Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. The Taliban's attack on a 15-year-old human rights campaigner in Pakistan has drawn condemnation within the country and throughout the world. Taliban militants stopped a school van and shot Malala Yousafzai in the head and injured two other girls in the van. The child was recently flown to Britain, where doctors were trying to save her life. Joining us in the Global Journalist studio today is a Pakistani journalist who will put this attack in perspective and in context. Umar Chima writes on corruption, politics, national security, and human rights for The News, the largest English-language newspaper in Pakistan. Umar, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you.
Now, Umar has been abducted, tortured, run over by a car, and anonymously threatened, all because of his writing on issues in his country. He came to the Missouri School of Journalism to receive a Missouri Honor Medal for distinguished service in journalism. Congratulations on getting that honor.
Thank you.
Now, in Pakistan, what's been the response to this attack on Malala?
First of all, this attack is a chilling reminder that we still have the Taliban, and they are in the position to threaten us, and they are in the position to, put the lives of many people at the risk, and they are in a position. They are so barbaric that they don't think for a moment before hitting a child. Everybody they realize who is against them or who can be against them. It's that person, male or female, is their target. Second, this attack has brought Pakistan a national shame. It's really unfortunate. And it has shaken the nerves of people. We have a number of tragedies in recent couple of years, and this is one of them. It is one of those tragedies that you cannot erase from the public memories.
Yes.
It has created resonance with the people. The response has been very overwhelming. The response was matching to the atrocity. Because I have seen and I have read since the incident, I am outside the country, and I kept following the stories. I've seen that even some Islamist groups, they have also supported the military operation against these people. And I was just reading one religious scholar yesterday, and he said, this attack is on the attack of the ideology of Islam, because they have their own way of interpretation. But his point was that Islam prohibits the girls from going to school. So what they are doing, that they have their violent version of Islam, and nobody can condone it.
Now let's get back a little bit to the specifics of this case, and then we can broaden it again and talk about the wider impact. Now, Malala was from an area of Pakistan called Swat. It's a settled area, an area where the outside the tribal areas that the Taliban took control of, and then the military came back in and retook control.
Yeah.
And tell us about what Malala did bring awareness of this issue of girls not being allowed to go to school.
Malala is a daughter of an educationist. Her father is also involved in the peace activities being carried out in the insurgency hit area, and he was very instrumental in bringing peace there. So being daughter, it means that you have something in your blood that you keep doing it. You learned it from your father. You learned through the surroundings that you are just a little child, and you have realized you had the dreams, and you realized at one point that the doors of education are being closed on us. So this is a point where she started writing diaries for BBC. And just imagine a diary by an old man or who is in mid-30s that may not have created such an impact as the diary of a 11-year-old girl. So it created a lot of impact, and you know that it captured the attention of the world community that how the girls are being targeted and how their dreams are being shattered. And now she had become a symbol of resistance. She had become a symbol of the rights of the child. She was campaigning for the education. And you know that if you get to hear her, you know, you cannot imagine that she is just 14-year-old. Her talk makes sense. It's not childish. And, you know, sometimes she looks very mature. And I was just watching her interview the other day, and she was saying that I wanted to become a politician. The host of a television program said, why? She said that, you know, that we need sincere people. You know that the country is in a dire mess. I want to do something for my country.
Right.
So it was really moving.
Yes.
And it has moved many people. And the attack on, it's the attack on whole Pakistan.
Now, do you think this indicates that the Taliban is growing desperate? Or what is it? What does this say about the Taliban and its overall
significance? They underestimated. They didn't have the idea about the impact.
But they also said that if she survives, they'll try to kill her again.
Yeah, they are very desperate. But you know that when they say that, we will also attack on the media because they have highlighted and they have blown up the case out of proportion, it means that they have realized something bad has been done by them. Bad in a sense that has been widely condemned by the people in Pakistan. They don't care about the international community, but they are caring what people in Pakistan realize, because they have to neutralize them to keep fighting against the army.
Right.
So the rest of the forces, they can say they are infidels or something. You know, you can give them any bad names. But the people of Pakistan, they are conscious about their opinion. How do they think?
Now, does the attack have any bearing on the potential peace talks between the government and the militants?
There was no peace talk going on between them. Yes, there was an uneasy peace. There was a kind of ceasefire. Let me explain you one more thing. When we talk about the Taliban or militants, actually there is not one group, there are many groups. The guys who were operating from Swat, they are a different group. The guys who are operating from the tribal area, there were different groups. And recently, just a week before this attack, a Pakistani politician led a march towards the Waziristan area. He wanted to, carry out anti-drone peace march. And initially he wanted to go to the South Waziristan. And later he dropped the idea and he decided to go to North Waziristan. And people kept asking the questions that why he changed the mind. Because most of the drone strikes are carried out in the South.
Right.
And later we found out, in fact, in South Waziristan, there are 14 groups of Taliban. So taking them into confidence to all of them that we are here and I am coming here with the thousands of people and can you ensure that nobody will be hurt? It was very difficult to get guarantee from these 14 groups. In contrast, there were two Taliban groups operating from the North Waziristan. So he decided to go there and just meeting them through their own people or negotiating with them. It was relatively easy.
Right.
So you know that it's a kind of loose network, and they operate on their own, and they have their own vision, and they have their own objective. Sometimes they kidnap people from the settled area, and one group kidnap the people, kidnap some person, some influential person, and They may sell the kidnap to the another person, and they say that let's negotiate us and how much money you need. So this is, you know, that sometimes they change them like crop.
Right.
You know, they behave like middlemen, that one product has been introduced by somebody and now he is selling to other and passing it on. And sometimes such people, they are transferred to the Afghanistan also.
I'm going to put the geography in context now. North Waziristan and South Waziristan is along the Afghan border.
Yeah.
And, you know, militants have been going, Taliban and other militants have been going across the border to fight against the NATO forces, and the drone strikes have been against the militants across the border in Pakistan, in Waziristan.
Yeah.
So how does this affect the Malala case and the aftermath of that and the changing sentiments within Pakistan? How does that affect what's going on in Afghanistan and the peace talks and the efforts to try to find some more peace there involving the Taliban and the government.
I'll explain it into two parts. Okay. First, let me take you back to 2009. In 2009, when the SWAT operation was conducted, before the operation was started, a girl was flogged in broad daylight, and a video was put on the put on YouTube, and this created a lot of resonance with the people. Army wanted to conduct an operation in the beginning, and there was no support for it. And after the video was released, everybody turned against these Talibans. They thought that they are barbaric. They are so inhuman.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot stand with them, and we have to fight them out. So that operation was conducted with full public support, and it turned out to be successful. And to my understanding, or what can I remember, I think this is the only operation that can be declared a successful operation because it was carried out with the public support. Now, we have Taliban in South Waziristan. Again, there are many groups. There are some groups who fight against Pakistan Army, and there are groups who cross into Afghanistan and fight against the NATO forces. Now, the trouble is, the NATO forces are concerned only about the Taliban who are fighting against them. And Pakistani forces are concerned about the about only those Taliban who are fighting against them. But they don't, the NATO and Pakistan, they don't want to, you know, conduct a joint operation, or they don't want to fight them together at the same time. For instance, if the drone strikes are carried out, they are carried out at the target of those Taliban who are hitting the NATO forces. So yeah. Pakistani forces say that, you know, these guys, they have rocked the country and they conducted, they carried suicide bombing throughout Pakistan. And in certain cases, we have passed the intelligence that these guys are living there. Why don't they hit them with the drones? So, you know, that it's very, very complicated.
So the situation is
getting very complicated. On one side, you say that Pakistan support Taliban. On the other side, the Taliban, if somebody talks with them, they say that the Pakistani forces, they are very dodgy. We cannot trust on them. So,
well, it boils down to, in some ways, a lack of cooperation between the West, NATO and the U.S. military and the Pakistani military, which, of course, was brought to light when in the attack on bin Laden's compound.
Absolutely,
and when the U.S. forces did not even notify the military.
Yeah, yeah.
And the compound was within an area where a lot of military personnel lived outside of Islamabad. And, you know, just to, you know, of course, the distinction is that's an al-Qaeda situation, although the Taliban supported al-Qaeda.
Absolutely, separate.
But I understand lately there have also, in the last few days, there have been some protests against the drone strikes.
Yeah.
What do the ordinary Pakistanis think about the drone strikes?
Ordinary Pakistani doesn't think good about the drone strikes. First of all, they live far away from the areas hit by them. It also has very adverse impact. People living in the area, because you know that the drones, you know, there is a buzz sound people keep hearing. And I spoke to a number of psychiatrists, and they said that the number of patients have been increased in the area because you know that it has adverse impact on their psychology and the psychology of people. You know that they realize that everybody is here. Even we have a cadet college there. The students, they are taught there. And now they have become used to this sound, you know, that the drones are moving right. around and they don't know where they can hit. But the satisfying factor for the people of that area, that with certain exceptions, in most of the cases, drone hit the target. Politically speaking, the drone strikes are very counterproductive because first people realize that these are the American, American planes that are hitting inside Pakistan. And second, people realize that the civilians are being killed. And now when there are reports from the America and from the UK, so if you talk to somebody who is sympathizer with the Taliban, he will say that, you know, that even the American institutions are saying that civilians are being killed. So it gives them credence. And I realize that only one solution that I understand it's not going to happen, but that could be the solution if the drones are allowed to be operated by Pakistan. Because when it is done by Pakistani forces, nobody will object inside Pakistan, no matter people object outside or not. So when it is done by, you know, that American forces, people will create a storm. Otherwise, in different areas, the army is engaged in operations and people are being killed. And we just have moderate condemnation about them inside Pakistan, not more than that.
Right. And what's now with the U.S. and NATO troops pulling out of Afghanistan, how will that affect the efforts against the Taliban? And how do you think that will what do Pakistanis feel about the Americans pulling out and the U.S. troops and the NATO troops out of Afghanistan?
Look, U.S. still today, they don't have any post-2014 plan at what is going to happen. And this is a cause of constant concern for Pakistan because they realize that we cannot change neighbors. We have to deal with these militants. So why should we turn against them for the sake of United States? And once they are pulled out, we'll be at their mercy. So what they do? They remain in, they make peace with some, and they fight with other people because they realize that there are so many groups and we cannot fight them together. And rather, we have to fight them through, we have to fight the Taliban through Taliban, through good Taliban and bad Taliban.
Yeah.
So this is how can we break them. Otherwise, if we start, if we wage a joint fight against all of them, we cannot do it. And when they look at the history, that at many points, Pakistan became U.S. ally. You know, that CETO, CENTO lie, and later we joined the United States when Russia invaded. And once the job is done, U.S. left, not only left, Pakistan, the sanctions were imposed and Pakistan. So they realized that we are still in tension. And at a time when United States needs Pakistan, and what happen, what will happen once the troops are pulled out, and you know, it's very. I don't see any good future in a good future because I realize that in case Taliban win, it's not good for Pakistan, and many people are mistaking it in United States that and the army realize that the Taliban are precious asset for them. They realize because they have they are out of their control. And they realize that they cannot be controlled properly. So they want a joint government where there are some secular elements in Afghanistan plus Taliban. Because you know that in a conflict scenario, you cannot make a peace without involving those who have the potential to spoil the peace. So they are the potential spoilers. And without bringing them into the loop, you cannot bring peace.
Right.
So they have to be involved, but not that they should be handed over 100% control.
Okay. Now, before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our video podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to today's program on our website. So please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org. Or you can go to our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter under our new handle at GlobalJourn. That's Global J-O-U-R-N. Now, I wanted to get back a little bit to Malala's story, but also add that there's another case involving a young girl that you wrote about that sparked outrage in Pakistan, Rimsha Masi, the blasphemy case. Could you tell us, you wrote about that in the news. Can you describe what happened and the fallout from that?
Yeah, Rimsha, actually we have a blasphemy law, and the blasphemy law is that if you say some, if you commit any insult or say something, just utter some insulting remarks about Islamic teachings or about the Prophet Muhammad, mm-hmm. and not only these two one, even if you say something against Jesus Christ or Moses or any prophet, you can be, you can be charged under this blasphemy law. But unfortunately, and you know that this law was made by the British government in the United States.
The British government?
Yeah, yeah. So it was strengthened by the Pakistani government, but it was introduced by the British government. And in even in United Kingdom, there was a blasphemy law till 2008.
And was the motivation to try to keep down religious conflicts?
Apparently, but you know that mostly religion can also be used for peace. But if you look around, most of the time it has been used for creating conflicts, for spreading the hatred.
Right, and you've been covering minority rights in Pakistan, yeah, quite a bit. In this case, it was Rimsha represented a minority.
Absolutely,
religion.
Yeah, she's from Christian religion, yeah.
Right, and she, what was her alleged act of blasphemy?
It's very ridiculous. Actually, they said that she has burned some pages of Holy Quran. And not even the Holy Quran. There was another textbook, you know, that like kindergarten textbook in terms of religious teaching. So it was not the Holy Quran, in fact. It was a kind of a kid's book in order to tell them how to read Quran. Okay.
Yeah.
So in fact, it was not Quran itself.
Right.
So they said that they have burned the pages of that book. And so she has committed blasphemy. But there was a background story. There were landlords fighting over the area. And most of the Christians in that area, they happened to be very poor, and they were given land in return of some favors. So they didn't pay for the land.
Right.
So they work on the landlord's home or at other places. So there was a conflict going on, and one landlord wanted to evacuate the area from the Christian community, and he wanted to build some commercial plaza in the area. And this is one story. Another story is that there was a Muslim boy who wanted to have some relations with that girl, and she refused, and he manipulated it. So there are two different stories going on,
right,
about it. She was alleged that that she has burned the pages. First of all, that where the pages came from, because she's not Muslim, and how did they?
So basically, they
yeah,
made
it was
they
a
made
fabricated
it up.
Story.
They made it up. Now you just running that down on time, but I wanted to briefly ask you about that. You interviewed Rimsha?
No. She is the most sought after person by the media, but you know that she has been kept in protective custody, realizing that she may be hit by some clergy. But it happened, the positive outcome of the story is, like, you know that in Malala case, it has created resonance. This Rimsha case has also created resonance with the people. In the past, the clergy used to exploit such issues in their favor. And in this case, a case has been registered against the clergy for fabricating the story, and now he is facing the trial. And Rimsha has been kept in a protective custody, and she has refused to leave Pakistan, and she said that she will fight while living in Pakistan.
Now, just to kind of wrap things up, and you're going back to Pakistan in a few days. What are your thoughts about the future? Are you optimistic, or do you think things are going to continue to be bad for a while, just general conditions in Pakistan and also the issue of the Taliban?
You know, the situation is very, very precarious. My prime concern is the violence, and the violence is rampant in Pakistan. And this war on terror and these bomb blasts and, you know, the joblessness, it has, you know, that it has multiplied the frustration of the people. Now they want to settle the score through violence, and in every solution, they find violence as important component, that if it is done through this way, the issue can be resolved. So this is something most alarming. But on the other side, on the positive side, we have seen many good things happening in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Media has created awareness, and people are just fighting for their rights like in the West. And the judiciary is very assertive, and they take the human rights issue very seriously. And there are groups who started, at one point they started separate movements for separate states. Now they have posed their trust on the judiciary, and they said this is the institution we can trust upon. So these are the good signs also.
Great. Now we've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today was Umar Chima, correspondent for The News and winner of the Medal of Honor here at the university. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. Sirvani Pair was our lead producer. Now stay with us for Free Press Watch and join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now, Free Press Watch, a segment on Global Journalist, where each week we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Nina Pantic. Today's news comes from PM News Nigeria, Amsterdam News, and the Committee to Protect Journalists. A Nigerian journalist was awarded more than $500,000 after winning a court case. He was brutally assaulted in 2009 while covering a peaceful rally at the Guarantee Trust Bank in Abuja, where customers were protesting fraudulent ATM withdrawals said to be made by bank officials. Desmond Udomwen, a senior reporter for PM News Nigeria, was beaten by police and bank staff members. He was battered unconscious with gun butts, and his equipment was confiscated. He was detained for several hours without medical treatment. After Udomwen sued the police nearly 3 years ago, the judge announced October 4th that the incident violated several constitutional rights: freedom from inhumane and degrading treatment, freedom of the press and expression, and the right to own property. In Nigeria's 52-year history as an independent nation, this is the largest award for a journalist. For information on these and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Nina Pantic.